especially this one, which had been without a woman for almost a year. She brought to Abraham all the love and affection she had given her own. The boy returned it, and in later years, when his memory of Nancy Hanks Lincoln had paled, referred to the one who took her place as my angel mother, saying, "All that I am I owe to my angel mother." For one thing, she saw to it that the boy went to school. Previously, he had not gone much deeper into learning than his ABCs, and only then at such times as his father felt he could spare him from his chores. Now, at intervals, he was able to fit in brief weeks of schooling, amounting in all to something under a year. They were blab schools, which meant that the pupils studied aloud at their desks, and the master judged the extent of their concentration by the volume of their din. Between such periods of formal education, he studied at home, ciphering on boards when he had no slate, and shaving them clean with a knife for an eraser. He developed a talent for mimicry, too, mounting a stump when out with a work gang and delivering mock orations and sermons. This earned him the laughter of the men who would break off work to watch him, but his father disapproved of such interruptions and would speak to him sharply or cuff him off the stump. He grew tall and angular with long muscles, so that in his early teens he could grip an axe one-handed at the end of the helve and hold it out, untrembling. Neighbors testified to his skill with this implement, one saying, "He can sink an axe deeper into wood than any man I ever saw," and another, "If you heard him felling trees in a clearing, you would say there was three men at work by the way the trees fell." However, though he did his chores, including work his father hired him out to do, he developed no real liking for manual labor. He would rather be reading what few books he got his hands on. Parson Weems's Life of Washington, Pilgrim's Progress, Aesop's Fables, Robinson Crusoe, Grimshaw's History of the United States, and The Kentucky Preceptor. Sometimes he managed to combine the two, for in plowing he would stop at the end of a row, reading while he gave the horse a breather. From a flatboat trip 1,000 miles downriver to New Orleans, during which he learned to trim a deck and man a sweep, he returned in time for his 21st birthday and another family migration, from Indiana out to central Illinois, where he and a cousin hired out to split 4,000 rails for their neighbors. Thus he came to manhood, a rail splitter, wilderness born and frontier raised. He was of the West, the new country out beyond the old, a product of a nation fulfilling a manifest destiny. It was in his walk, in his talk, and in his character, indelibly. It would be with him wherever he went, along with the knowledge that he had survived in a region where the Lord spared the fitten, and the rest he seen fitten to let die. He had never had much fondness for his father, and now that he was legally independent, he struck out on his own. The family moved once more, deeper into Illinois, but Lincoln did not go with them. He took instead another flatboat trip down to New Orleans, and then came back to another kind of life. This was prairie country, with a rich soil and a future. Lincoln got a job clerking in a New Salem store at $15 a month plus a bed to sleep in. He defeated the leader of the regional toughs in a wrestling match, and when the leader's friends pitched in, Lincoln backed against a wall and dared them to come at him one by one, whereupon they acknowledged him as their new leader. This last was rather in line with the life he had led before, but he found something new as well. He attended the New Salem Debating Society, and though at first the charter members snickered at his looks and awkwardness, presently they were admiring the logic and conciseness of his arguments. "All he lacked was culture," one of them said. Lincoln took such encouragement from his success that in the spring of 1832 he announced as a candidate for the state legislature. The Black Hawk War interrupting his campaign, he enlisted and was elected captain by his fellow volunteers. Discipline was not strong among them. The new commander's first order to one of his men brought the reply, "You go to hell." They saw no action, and Lincoln afterwards joked about his military career, saying that all the blood he lost was to mosquitoes, and all his charges were against wild onion beds. When the company's 30-day enlistment expired, he re-enlisted for another 20 days as a private, then came home and resumed his campaign for the legislature, 2 weeks remaining until election day. His first political speech was made at a country auction. 23 years old, he stood on a box, wearing a frayed straw hat, a calico shirt, and pantaloons held up by a single-strapped suspender. As he was about to speak, a fight broke out in the crowd. Lincoln stepped down, broke up the fight, then stepped back onto the box. "Gentlemen and fellow citizens," he said, "I presume you all know who I am. I am humble Abraham Lincoln. I have been solicited by many friends to become a candidate for the legislature. My politics are short and sweet, like the old woman's dance. I am in favor of a national bank. I am in favor of the internal improvements system and a high protective tariff. These are my sentiments and political principles. If elected, I shall be thankful. If not, it will be all the same." Election day, he ran 8th in a field of 13, but he received 277 of the 300 votes in the New Salem precinct. It was probably then that Lincoln determined to run for the same office next time around. Meanwhile, there was a living to earn. He could always split rails and do odd jobs. These he did, and then went into partnership in a grocery store that failed, leaving him a debt beyond $1,000. The national debt, he called it ruefully, and worked for years to pay it off. He became village postmaster, sometimes carrying letters in his hat, which became a habit. He studied surveying and worked a while at that. He also began the study of law, reading Blackstone and Chitty, and improved his education with borrowed books. His name was becoming more widely known. He was winning popularity by his great strength and his ability at telling funny stories, but mostly by his force of character. Then in the spring of 1834, when another legislature race came round, he conducted an all-out full-time campaign and was elected. With borrowed money, he bought his first tailor-made suit, paying $60 for it, and left for the first of his 4 terms in the state lawmaking body, learning the rough-and-tumble give-and-take of Western politics. 2 years later, he was licensed as an attorney and soon afterwards moved to Springfield as a partner in a law firm. He said goodbye to the manual labor he had been so good at, yet had never really liked. From now on, he would work with his head as a leader of men. His ambition became what Herndon later called a little engine. Springfield was about to be declared the state capital, moved there from Vandalia largely through Lincoln's efforts in the legislature, and here he began to acquire that culture which the New Salem intellectuals had said was all he lacked. The big work-splayed hands were losing their horn-hard calluses. He settled down to the law, becoming in time an excellent trial lawyer and a capable stump debater at political rallies, even against such opponents as Stephen A. Douglas, the coming little giant. Socially, however, he was slow in getting started. About a month after his arrival, he wrote in a letter, "I have been spoken to by but one woman since I've been here, and should not have been by her if she could have avoided it." He was leery of the ladies, having once remarked, half-jokingly, "A woman is the only thing I am afraid of that I know will not hurt me." Nevertheless, by the time he was elected to his 4th term in the legislature, Lincoln was courting Mary Todd, a visitor from Lexington, Kentucky, and in early November of 1842, he married her. It was an attraction of opposites, and as such it was stormy. At one point they broke off the engagement. She left Illinois, and Lincoln had to go to Kentucky for a reconciliation before she would return to Springfield and marry him in her sister's parlor. If culture was what he was after, still, Lincoln again had moved in the proper direction. His wife, the great-granddaughter of a revolutionary general, had attended a private academy in Lexington, where she learned to speak French, read music after a fashion, paint on china, and dance the sedate figures of the time. At 24 she was impulsive and vivacious, short and rather plump, looking especially so alongside her long, lean husband, who was 33. Lincoln seemed to take it calmly enough. 5 days after the wedding he wrote to a lawyer friend, "Nothing new here, except my marrying, which to me is matter of profound wonder." Their first child, Robert Todd, called Bob, was born the following year. 3 others came in the course of the next decade, all sons. Edward and William and Thomas, called Eddie, Willie, Tad. Eddie died before he was 5, and Tad had a cleft palate. He spoke with a lisp. The Lincolns lived a year in rented rooms, then moved into the $1,500 white frame house, which remained their home. They took their place in Springfield society, and Lincoln worked hard at law, riding the 8th Judicial Circuit in all kinds of weather, a clean shirt and a change of underwear in his saddlebag, along with books and papers and a yellow flannel nightshirt. Fees averaged about $5 a case, sometimes paid in groceries, which he was glad to get, since the cost of the house represented something beyond 1 year's total earnings. Home life taught him patience, for his wife was high-strung as well as high-born. He called her mother and met her fits of temper with forbearance, which must have been the last thing she wanted at the time. When her temper got too hot, he would walk off to his office and stay until it cooled. Accustomed to Negro house slaves in Kentucky, Mary Lincoln could not get along with Illinois hired girls who were inclined to answer back. Lincoln did what he could here, too, slipping the girls an extra weekly dollar for compensation. Once, after a particularly bitter scene between mistress and maid, when Mrs. Lincoln had left the room, he patted the girl on the shoulder and gave her the same advice he had given himself. "Stay with her, Maria. Stay with her." His law practice grew. He felt prepared to grow in other directions. Having completed his 4th term in the state legislature, he was ready to move on up the political ladder. He wrote to Whig associates in the district, "Now, if you should hear anyone say that Lincoln don't want to go to Congress, I wish you as a personal friend of mine would tell him you have reason to believe he is mistaken. The truth is, I would like to go very much." In the backstage party scramble, however, he lost the nomination in 1842 and again in 1844. It was 1847 before he got to Congress. From a back row on the Whig side of the House, he came to know the voices and faces of men he would know better. Ashman of Massachusetts, Red of South Carolina, Smith of Indiana, Toombs and Stevens of Georgia. While a visit to the Senate would show him the elder statesmen Webster and Calhoun, along with newer men of note, such as Cameron of Pennsylvania and Davis of Mississippi. The Mexican War had ended by then, and though Lincoln voted for whatever army supply bills came before the House, like most Whigs, he attacked the motives behind the war, which now was being spoken of, by Northern Whigs at least, as infamous and wicked, an imperialist attempt to extend the slavery realm. This got him into trouble back home, where the Democratic papers began calling him a Latter-day Benedict Arnold, and the people read and noted all he did as a slur against the volunteers of his state. When Congress convened for his 2nd session, Lincoln was the only Whig from Illinois. It was a hectic session, anyhow, with tempers flaring over the question of slavery in the territories. He came home with no chance for re-election and did not try. He gave up politics, refusing even a spoils offer of the governorship of Oregon Territory, and returned to the practice of law, once more riding the circuit. Disheartened, he paused now to restore his soul through work and meditation. Though he did not believe at the outset that it would necessarily ever reach an end, indeed he believed it would not, otherwise it could never have done for him what it did, this 5-year retreat, coming as it did between his 40th and his 45th years, 1849 to 1854, was his interlude of greatest growth. Like many, perhaps most men of genius, Lincoln developed late. It was a time for study, a time for self-improvement. He went back and drilled his way through the first 6 books of Euclid, as an exercise to discipline his mind. Not politics, but the law was his main interest now. Riding the circuit, he talked less and listened more. Together with a new understanding and a deeper reading of Shakespeare and the Bible, this brought him a profounder faith in people, including those who had rejected him and repudiated what he had to offer as a leader. Here, too, he was learning. This was the period in which he was reported to have said, "You can fool some of the people all the time, and all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time." Non-participation in public affairs did not mean a loss of interest in them. Lincoln read the papers more carefully now than he had ever done before, learning from them of the deaths of Calhoun, Clay, and Webster, whose passing marked the passing of an era. When the 1850 Compromise, as he and most men believed, including Clay, who engineered it shortly before his death, settled the differences that had brought turmoil to the nation and fistfights to the floors of Congress while Lincoln himself was there, he breathed easier. But not for long. The conflict soon was heading up again. Uncle Tom's Cabin came from the presses in a stream. Southern nationalists were announcing plans for the annexation of Cuba. The case of the slave Dred Scott, suing for his freedom, moved by legal osmosis through the courts. The Whigs seemed lost and the Democrats were splitting. Then Lincoln's old stump opponent, Stephen A. Douglas, who was 4 years younger than Lincoln but who had suffered no setback in political advancement, filling now his second term in the Senate, brought the crisis to a head. Scarcely taller than Napoleon, but with all that monarch's driving ambition and belief in a private star, Douglas moved to repeal that part of the Missouri Compromise which served to restrict the extension of slavery. This came as a result of his championing a northern route for the proposed Pacific Railway. A southern route was also proposed, and Douglas sought to effect a swap, reporting a bill for the organization of two new territories, Kansas and Nebraska, with the provision that the people there should determine for themselves as to the admission or exclusion of slavery, despite the fact that both areas lay well north of the 36 degrees 30 minutes line drawn by the compromise, which had guaranteed that the institution would be kept forever south of there. The Southerners were glad to abandon their New Mexico route for such a gain, provided the repeal was made not only implicit but explicit in the bill. Douglas was somewhat shocked. He brought a certain naivety to even his deepest plots, but soon agreed, and Secretary of War Jefferson Davis persuaded Franklin Pierce to make the bill an administration issue. Popular sovereignty, Douglas called it. Squatter sovereignty, his opponents considered a better name. It will raise a hell of a storm, Douglas predicted. It did indeed, though the Democrats managed to ram it through by late May of 1854, preparing the ground for bleeding Kansas and the birth of the Republican Party that same year. Another effect of the Kansas-Nebraska bill was that it brought Lincoln out of retirement. It had raised even more of a storm than Douglas predicted, and not only in Congress. For when the senator came home to Illinois, he saw through the train window his effigy being burned in courthouse squares. And when he came to explain his case before 8,000 people in Chicago, they jeered him off the rostrum. He left, shaking his fist in their faces, and set out to stump the state with a speech that confounded opposition orators and won back many of the voters. Then in early October he came to Springfield, packing the hall of the House of Representatives. After the speech, which had been as successful here as elsewhere in turning the jeers to cheers, the crowd filed out through the lobby and saw Abraham Lincoln standing on the staircase, announcing that he would reply to Douglas the following day and inviting the senator to be present, to answer if he cared. Next day they were there, close-packed as yesterday. Douglas had a front-row seat. It was hot, and Lincoln spoke in shirt sleeves, wearing no collar or tie. His voice was shrill as he began, though presently it settled to lower tones, interrupted from time to time by crackles and thunders of applause. Wet with sweat, his shirt clung to his shoulders and big arms. He had written his speech out beforehand, clarifying in his own mind his position as to slavery, which he saw as the nub of the issue, much to the discomfort of Douglas, who wanted to talk about popular sovereignty, keeping the issue one of self-government, whereas Lincoln insisted on going beyond, making slavery the main question. Emerging from his long retirement, having restored his soul, he was asking himself and all men certain questions. And now the Lincoln music began to sound. The doctrine of self-government is right, absolutely and eternally right, but it has no just application as here attempted. Or perhaps I should rather say that whether it has such just application depends upon whether a Negro is not or is a man. If he is not a man, why in that case, he who is a man may, as a matter of self-government, do just as he pleases with him. But if the Negro is a man, is it not to that extent a total destruction of self-government to say that he too shall not govern himself? When the white man governs himself, that is self-government. But when he governs himself and also governs another man, that is more than self-government. That is despotism. If the Negro is a man, why then my ancient faith teaches me that all men are created equal, and that there can be no moral right in connection with one man's making a slave of another. He believed that it was a moral wrong. He had not come to believe that it was a legal wrong, though he believed that too would be clarified in time. The words of his mouth came like meditations from his heart. Slavery is founded in the selfishness of man's nature, opposition to it in his love of justice. These principles are an eternal antagonism, and when brought into collision so fiercely as slavery extension brings them, shocks and throes and convulsions must ceaselessly follow. Repeal the Missouri Compromise, repeal all compromises. Repeal the Declaration of Independence, repeal all past history. You still cannot repeal human nature. It still will be the abundance of man's heart that slavery extension is wrong, and out of the abundance of his heart, his mouth will continue to speak. This, in part, was the speech that caused his name to be recognized throughout the Northwest, though personally he was still but little known outside his state. He repeated it 12 days later in Peoria, where shorthand reporters took it down for their papers, and continued to speak in central Illinois and in Chicago. Winning re-election to the legislature, he presently had a chance at a seat in the U.S. Senate. His hopes were high, and he resigned from the legislature to be eligible, but at the last minute he had to throw his votes to an anti-Nebraska Democrat to defeat the opposition. Again he had failed, and again he regretted failing. Yet this time he was not despondent. He kept working and waiting. His law practice boomed. He earned a $5,000 fee on a railroad case and was retained to assist a high-powered group of big-city lawyers on a patents case in Cincinnati. But when they saw him come to town, wearing his usual rusty clothes and carrying a ball-handled blue cotton umbrella, they would scarcely speak to him. One of the attorneys, Edwin M. Stanton of Pittsburgh, was downright rude. "Where did that long-armed creature come from?" he asked within earshot. Lincoln went his way, taking no apparent umbrage. Politically, he was wary too, writing to a friend, "Just now I fear to do anything lest I do wrong." He had good cause for fear, and so had all men through this time of shocks and throes and convulsions. Popular sovereignty was being tested in Kansas in a manner Douglas had not foreseen. Missouri border ruffians and hired abolitionist gunmen were cutting each other's throats for votes in the coming referendum. The Mormons were resisting federal authority in the West, and while a ruinous financial panic gripped the East, the Know-Nothing Party was sweeping New England with anti-foreigner, anti-Catholic appeals. The Whigs had foundered, the Democrats had split on all those rocks. Like many men just now, Lincoln hardly knew where he stood along party lines. "I think I am a Whig," he wrote, "but others say there are no Whigs, and that I am an abolitionist. I am not a know-nothing, that is certain. How could I be? How can anyone who abhors the oppression of Negroes be in favor of degrading classes of white people? Our progress in degeneracy appears to me to be pretty rapid." He was waiting and looking, and then he found the answer. It was 1856, a presidential election year. Out of the Nebraska crisis, 2 years before, the Republican Party had been born, a coalition of foundered Whigs and disaffected Northern Democrats, largely abolitionist at the core. They made overtures to Lincoln, but he dodged them at the time, not wanting a radical tag attached to his name. Now, however, seeking to unify the anti-Nebraska elements in Illinois, he came to meet them. As a delegate to the state convention, he caught fire and made what may have been the greatest speech of his career, though no one would ever really know, since the heat of his words seemed to burn them from men's memory. And in that conglomerate mass of gaping, howling old-line Whigs and bolted Democrats, know-nothings, free-soilers, and abolitionists, even the shorthand reporters sat enthralled, forgetting to use their pencils. From now on, he was a Republican. He would take his chances with the radical tag. At the National Convention in Philadelphia, he received 110 votes on the first ballot for the vice presidential nomination, yielding them on the second to a New Jersey running mate for John C. Fremont of California. Lincoln had not favored Fremont, but he worked hard for him in the campaign that saw the election of the Democratic nominee James Buchanan, an elderly bachelor whose main advantage lay in the fact that he was the least controversial candidate, having been out of the country as minister to England during the trying past 3 years. The Republicans were by no means dispirited at running second. They sniffed victory down the wind in the race 4 years from now, provided only that the turmoil and sectional antagonism should continue, which seemed likely. At this point, the United States Supreme Court handed down a decision which appeared to cut the ground from under all their feet. The test case of the slave Dred Scott, suing for freedom on a plea that his master had taken him into a territory where slavery was forbidden by the Missouri Compromise, had at last reached the High Court. In filing the majority opinion, Chief Justice Roger B. Taney dismissed Scott's lawyer's claim. A Negro, he said, was not a citizen of the United States and therefore had no right to sue in a federal court. This was enough to enrage the abolitionists who secretly had sponsored the suit. But Taney went even further. The Missouri Compromise itself was void, he declared. Congress had no power over territories except to prepare for their admission to the Union. Slaves being private property, Congress had no right to exclude them anywhere. According to this decision, popular sovereignty went into the discard, since obviously whatever powers Congress lacked would be lacked by any territorial legislature created by Congress. The reaction was immediate and uproarious. Secession, formerly the threat of the South, now came as a cry from the North, particularly New England, where secessionist meetings were held in many towns. Douglas, on the other hand, digested the bitter dose as best he could, then announced that the decision was in fact a vindication of his repeal of the compromise 2 years before, as well as a confirmation of the principles of popular sovereignty, since slavery, whether legal or not, could never thrive where the people did not welcome it. Lincoln did not mask his disappointment. He believed the decision was erroneous and harmful, but he respected the judgment of the court and urged his followers to work toward the time when the 5-4 decision would be reversed. Meanwhile, during the off year 1857, he prepared to run for the Senate against Douglas, whose third term would expire the following year. Just then, unexpectedly, Douglas split with the administration over the adoption of a constitution for Kansas. Threatened with expulsion from his party, he swung over to the Republicans on the issue, bringing many Democrats along with him. The Republicans were surprised and grateful, and it began to look as if Lincoln would be passed over again when nominating time came round. However, they were too accustomed to fighting the little giant to break off hostilities now. They nominated Lincoln at the state convention in mid-June. Lincoln was ready, and more than ready. He had not only prepared his acceptance, but now, for the first time, he read a speech from manuscript, as if to emphasize his knowledge of the need for precision. It was at this point that Lincoln's political destiny and the destiny of the nation became one. The first paragraph once more summed up his thinking and struck the keynote for all that was to follow. "If we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could better judge what to do and how to do it. We are now far into the fifth year since a policy was initiated with the avowed object and confident promise of putting an end to slavery agitation. Under the operation of that policy, that agitation has not only not ceased, but has constantly augmented. In my opinion, it will not cease until a crisis shall have been reached and passed. A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the House to fall. But I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other. Either the opponents of slavery will arrest the further spread of it and place it where the public mind shall be at rest in the belief that it is in the course of ultimate extinction, or its advocates will push it forward till it shall have become alike lawful in all the states, old as well as new, north as well as south." Seizing upon this as proof of Lincoln's radicalism and declaring that it proved him not only a proponent of sectional discord but also a reckless prophet of war, Douglas came home and launched an all-out campaign against the Republicans and the Democrats who had not walked out with him. He spoke in Chicago to a crowd that broke into frenzies of cheers, then set out to stump the state, traveling with a retinue of secretaries, stenographers, and influential admirers in a gaily bannered private car placed at his disposal by George B. McClellan, chief engineer of the Illinois Central, who also provided a flat car mounting a brass cannon to boom the announcement that the little giant was coming down the line. Traveling unaccompanied on an ordinary ticket, Lincoln moved in his wake, sometimes on the same train, addressing the crowds attracted by the Douglas panoply. At last he made the arrangement formal, challenging his opponent to a series of debates. Douglas, with nothing to gain, could not refuse. He agreed to meet Lincoln once in each of the seven congressional districts where they had not already spoken. Thus the colorful Douglas-Lincoln debates got underway, the pudgy, well-tailored Douglas with his scowl, his luxurious mane of hair, gesturing aggressively as his voice wore to a froggy croak, and Lincoln in his claw-hammer coat and straight-leg trousers, tall and earnest, with a shrill voice that reached the outer edges of the crowd, bending his knees while he led up to a point, then straightening them with a jerk, rising to his full height as he made it. Crowds turned out, 10,000 to 15,000 strong, thronging the lonesome prairie towns. At Freeport, Lincoln threw Douglas upon the horns of a dilemma, asking, "Can the people of a United States territory in any lawful way exclude slavery from its limits prior to the formation of a state constitution?" If Douglas answered no, he would offend the free soil voters of Illinois. If he answered yes, he would make himself unacceptable to the South in the 1860 presidential campaign, toward which his ambition so clearly pointed. He made his choice. "Yes," he said, defying both the Supreme Court and the South, and thereby cinched the present election and stored up trouble for the future. Approaching 50, Lincoln again took defeat in his stride, turning once more to the practice of law to build up a flattened bank account. He was known throughout the nation now as a result of the cross-state debates. In his mail and in the newspapers, there began to appear suggestions that he was presidential timber, to which he replied, sometimes forthrightly, "I must in candor say I do not think I am fit for the presidency," sometimes less forthrightly, "I shall labor faithfully in the ranks unless, as I think not probable, the judgment of the party shall assign me a different position." Through the long hot summer of 1859, past 50 now, he wrote letters and made speeches and did in general what he could to improve the party strategy, looking toward next year's elections. Then, in mid-October, the Telegraph clacked a message that drove all such thoughts from men's minds. John Brown, called Osawatomie Brown after a massacre staged in Kansas, had seized the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, as the first step in leading a slave insurrection. His army counted 18 men, including 5 Negroes. "One man and God can overturn the universe," he said. Captured by United States Marines under Colonel Robert E. Lee, U.S. Army, he was tried in a Virginia court and sentenced to be hanged in early December. He had the backing of several New England abolitionists. They spent an anxious 6 weeks while the old fanatic kept their secret, close-mouthed behind his long gray beard. Seated on his coffin while he rode in a wagon to the gallows, he looked out at the hazy Blue Ridge Mountains. "This is a beautiful country," he said. "I never had the pleasure of really seeing it before." After the hanging, the jailer unfolded a slip of paper Brown had left behind, a prophecy. "I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood." This, too, was added to the issues men were split on. John Brown's soul went marching, a symbol of good or evil, depending on the viewer. Douglas, back in Washington, was quick to claim that such incidents of lawlessness and bloodshed were outgrowths of the House Divided speech. And Lincoln's name was better known than ever. In late February, just past his 51st birthday, Lincoln traveled to New York for a speech at Cooper Union. The city audience thought him strange as he stood there, tall and awkward in a new broadcloth suit that hung badly from having been folded in a satchel for the train ride. "Mr. Chairman," he began. Presently, however, the awkwardness was dropped, or else they forgot it. He spoke with calm authority, denying that the Republican Party was either sectional or radical, except as its opponents had made it so. Slavery was the issue, North and South, he said, probing once more for the heart of the matter. "All they ask we could readily grant if we thought slavery right. All we ask they could as readily grant if they thought it wrong. Their thinking it right and our thinking it wrong is the precise fact upon which depends the whole controversy. Thinking it right as they do, they are not to blame for desiring its full recognition as being right. But thinking it wrong as we do, can we yield to them? Can we cast our votes with their view and against our own? In view of our moral, social, and political responsibilities, can we do this?" He thought not. "If our sense of duty forbids this, then let us stand by our duty fearlessly and effectively. Neither let us be slandered from our duty by false accusations against us, nor frightened from it by menaces of destruction to the government, nor of dungeons to ourselves. Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it." That was the peroration, and the listeners surged from their seats to applaud him, waving handkerchiefs and hats as they came forward to wring his hand. 4 New York newspapers printed the speech in full next morning, and Lincoln went on into New England, making a series of addresses there before returning to Springfield, much enhanced. The time for presidential nominations was drawing close. When a friend asked if he would allow his name to be entered, Lincoln admitted, The taste is in my mouth a little. Chicago was the scene of the Republican National Convention, the result of a political maneuver toward the close of the previous year by one of Lincoln's supporters, who, poker-faced, had suggested the Western City as an ideal neutral site, since Illinois would have no candidate of her own. Now, in mid-May, however, as the delegates converged upon the raw pine wigwam put up to accommodate 10,000 in an atmosphere of victory foreseen, they found that Illinois had a candidate indeed, and something beyond the usual favorite son. Alongside such prominent men as William H. Seward of New York, Salmon P. Chase of Ohio, Edward Bates of Missouri, and Simon Cameron of Pennsylvania, Lincoln was comparatively unknown. Yet this had its advantages, since the shorter the public record a candidate presented, the smaller the target he would expose to the mud that was sure to be flung. Each of these men had disadvantages. Seward had spoken too often of the irrepressible conflict. Chase had been too radical. Bates was tainted by know-nothingism. And Cameron was said to be a crook. Besides all this, Lincoln came from the critical Northwest, where the political scale was likely to be tipped. His managers set up headquarters and got to work behind the scenes, giving commitments, making deals. Then, on the eve of balloting, they received a wire from Springfield. "I authorize no bargains and will be bound by none." "Lincoln ain't here and don't know what we have to meet," the managers said, and went on dickering right and left, promising cabinet posts and patronage, printing counterfeit admission tickets to pack the wigwam nomination morning. The Seward yell was met by the Lincoln yawp. The New Yorker led on the first ballot. On the second, there were readjustments as the others jockeyed for position. Lincoln was closing fast. On the third, he swept in. The wigwam vibrated with shouts and cheers, bells and whistles swelling the uproar while the news went out to the nation. "Just think of such a sucker as me being president," Lincoln had said. Yet in Springfield, when his friends came running, those who were not already with him in the newspaper office, they were somewhat taken aback at the new, calm, sure dignity which clothed him now like a garment. Lincoln himself did not campaign. No presidential candidate ever had, such action being considered incommensurate with the dignity of the office. Nor did two of his three opponents, but Douglas, the only one of the four who seemed to believe that the election might bring war, set forth to stump the country. All four were running on platforms that called for the preservation of the Union. The defeat of Lincoln depended solely on Douglas, however, since neither of the others could hope to carry the free states. Knowing this, Douglas worked with all his strength. Wherever he went, he was met by Lincoln men, including Seward, Chase, and Bates. The Republican campaign for Honest Abe the Rail Splitter was a colorful one, with poll raisings, barbecues, and torchlight parades. Douglas kept fighting. Then in August, when Lincoln supporters carried local elections in Maine and Vermont, and in October, when Pennsylvania and Ohio followed suit, Douglas saw what was coming. He told his secretary, "Mr. Lincoln is the next president. We must try to save the Union. I will go south." He did go south in a final attempt to heal the three-way Democratic split, but there men would not listen either. On Election Day, November 6th, though he ran closest to Lincoln in popular votes, he had the fewest electoral votes of all. That night, Lincoln sat in the Springfield Telegraph office, watching the tabulations mount to a climax. Bell, 588,879. Breckinridge, 849,781. Douglas, 1,376,957. Lincoln, 1,866,452. The combined votes of his opponents outnumbered his own by almost a million. He would be a minority president, like the indecisive Buchanan now in office. He had carried none of the 15 southern states, receiving not a single popular ballot in five of them, even from a crank. and no electoral votes at all. Yet he had carried all of the northern states except New Jersey, which he split with Douglas, so that the final electoral vote had a brighter aspect. Lincoln, 180, Breckinridge, 72, Bell, 39, Douglas, 12. Even if all the opposing popular votes had been concentrated on a single candidate, he would have received but 11 fewer electoral votes, which still would have left him more than he needed to win. Any way men figured it, North or South, barring assassination or an act of God, Abraham Lincoln would be President of the United States in March. How many states would remain united was another question. South Carolina had warned that she would secede if Lincoln was elected. Now she did, and within 3 of the 4 months that lay between the election and the inauguration, 6 others followed her out. Lincoln in Springfield gave no assurance that he would seek a compromise or be willing to accept one. "Stand firm," he wrote privately to an Illinois senator. "The tug has to come, and better now than any time hereafter." "Hold firm as with a chain of steel," he wrote to a friend in the House. He had troubles enough right there at home. "No bargains," he had wired his managers at the convention, but they had ignored him out of necessity. Now the claimants hedged him in, swarming into his home and office, plucking at his coat sleeve on the street. The week before his departure for Washington, he made a trip down to Coles County to say goodbye to Sally Bush Lincoln, the stepmother who had done for him all she could. When his father had died there 9 years back, Lincoln had not attended the funeral. But he took time out for this. He kissed her and held her close, then came back to Springfield, closed his office the final day, said goodbye to his partner Herndon, and went to the Chenery House for his last sleep in Illinois. Next morning dawned cold and drizzly. 8 o'clock was leaving time. Lincoln and his party of 15, together with those who had come to say goodbye, assembled in the waiting room of the small brick depot. They felt unaccountably depressed. There was a gloom about the gathering, no laughter and few smiles as people came forward for handshakes and farewells. When the stub funnel-stack locomotive blew the all aboard, they filed out of the station. The president-elect and those who were going with him boarded the single passenger car. Those who were staying collected about the back platform, the rain making a steady murmur against the taut cotton or silk of their umbrellas. As he stood at the rail, chin down, Lincoln's look of sadness deepened. Tomorrow he would be 52, one of the youngest men ever to fill the office he had won 3 months ago. Then he raised his head, and the people were hushed as he looked into their faces. "My friends," he said quietly above the murmur of the rain, "no one not in my situation can appreciate my feeling of sadness at this parting. To this place and the kindness of these people, I owe everything. Here I have lived for a quarter of a century and have passed from a young to an old man. Here my children have been born, and one is buried. I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return, with a task before me greater than that which rested upon Washington. Without the assistance of that divine being who ever attended him, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Trusting in him who can go with me and remain with you and be everywhere for good, let us confidently hope that all will yet be well. To his care commending you, as I hope in your prayers you will commend me, I bid you an affectionate farewell." The train pulled out and the people stood and watched it go, some with tears on their faces. 4 years and 2 months later, still down in Coles County, Sally Bush Lincoln was to say, "I knowed when he went away he wasn't ever coming back alive." 2. Throughout the 12 days of his roundabout trip to Washington, traversing 5 states along an itinerary that called for 20 speeches and an endless series of conferences with prominent men who boarded the train at every station, Lincoln's resolution to keep silent on the vital issues was made more difficult, if not impossible. Determined to withhold his plans until the inauguration had given him the authority to act as well as declare, he attempted to say nothing even as he spoke, and in this he was surprisingly successful. He met the crowds with generalities and the dignitaries with jokes, to the confusion and outrage of both. He told the Ohio legislature, "There is nothing going wrong. It is a consoling circumstance that when we look out, there is nothing that really hurts anybody. We entertain different views upon political questions, but nobody is suffering anything." With 7 states out of the Union, arsenals and mints seized along with vessels and forts, the Mississippi obstructed, the flag itself fired upon, this man could say there was nothing going wrong. His listeners shrugged and muttered at his ostrich policy. They had come prepared for cheers, and they did cheer him loudly each time he seemed ready to face the issue, as when he warned in New Jersey that if it became necessary to put the foot down firmly, they must support him. Even so, his appearance was not reassuring to the Easterners. In New York, he offended the sensibilities of many by wearing black kid gloves to the opera and letting his big hands dangle over the box rail. Taken in conjunction with the frontier accent and the shambling western gait, it made them wonder what manner of man they had entrusted with their destinies. Hostile papers called him gorilla and baboon, and as caricature the words seemed unpleasantly fitting. In Philadelphia, raising a flag at Independence Hall, he felt his breath quicken as he drew down on the halyard and saw the bright red and rippling blue of the bunting take the breeze. Turning to the crowd, he touched a theme he would return to. "I have often inquired of myself what great principle or idea it was that kept this Confederacy so long together. It was not the mere matter of the separation of the colonies from the motherland, but that something in the Declaration giving liberty, not alone to the people of this land, but hope to the world for all future time. It was that which gave promise that in due time the weights should be lifted from the shoulders of all men, and that all should have an equal chance." Men stood and listened with upturned faces, wanting fire for the tinder of their wrath, not ointment for their fears, and the music crept by them. It was not this they had come to hear. So far, Lincoln had seemed merely inadequate, inept, at worst a bumpkin. But now the trip was given a comic opera finish, in which he was called to play the part not only of a fool, but of a coward. Baltimore, the last scheduled stop before Washington, would mark his first entry into a slavery region as president-elect. The city had sent him no welcome message, as all the others had done, and apparently had made no official plans for receiving him or even observing his presence while he passed through. Unofficially, however, according to reports, there awaited him a reception quite different from any he had been given along the way. Bands of toughs called blood tubs roamed the streets, plotting his abduction or assassination. He would be stabbed or shot or both, or he would be hustled aboard a boat and taken south, the ransom being Southern independence. All this was no more than gossip until the night before the flag-raising ceremony in Philadelphia, when news came from reliable sources that much of it was fact. General Winfield Scott, head of the armed forces, wrote warnings. Senator Seward, slated for Secretary of State, sent his son with documentary evidence. And now came the railroad head with his detective, Alan Pinkerton, whose operatives had joined such Maryland bands, he said, and as members had taken deep and bloody oaths. Such threats and warnings had become familiar over the past 3 months, but hearing all this, Lincoln was disturbed. The last thing he wanted just now was an incident, least of all one with himself as a corpse to be squabbled over. His friends urged him to cancel the schedule and leave for Washington immediately. Lincoln refused, but agreed that if, after he had spoken at Philadelphia the next morning and at Harrisburg in the afternoon, no Baltimore delegation came to welcome him to that city, he would bypass it or go through unobserved. Next afternoon, when no such group had come to meet him, he returned to his hotel, put on an overcoat, stuffed a soft wool hat into his pocket, and went to the railroad station. There he boarded a special car, accompanied only by his friend Ward Hill Lamon, known to be a good man in a fight. As the train pulled out, all telegraph wires out of Harrisburg were cut. When the travelers reached Philadelphia about 10 o'clock that night, Pinkerton was waiting. He put them aboard the Baltimore train. They had berths reserved by a female operative for her invalid brother and his companion. At 3:30 in the morning, the sleeping car was drawn through the quiet Baltimore streets to Camden Station. While they waited, Lincoln heard a drunk bawling "Dixie" on the quay. Lamon, with his bulging eyes and sad frontier mustache, sat clutching 4 pistols and 2 large knives. At last the car was picked up by a train from the west, and Lincoln stepped onto the Washington platform at 6 o'clock in the morning. "You can't play that on me," a man said, coming forward. Lamon drew back his fist. "Don't strike him," Lincoln cried, and caught his arm, recognizing Elihu Washburn, an Illinois congressman. They went to Willard's Hotel for breakfast. Such was the manner in which the new leader entered his capital to take the oath of office. Though the friendly press was embarrassed to explain it, the hostile papers had a field day, using the basic facts of the incident as notes of a theme particularly suited for variations. The overcoat became a long military cloak, draping the lanky form from heels to eyes, and the wool hat became a Scotch plaid cap, a sort of tam-o'-shanter. Cartoonists drew fugitive sketches, showing Lincoln with his hair on end, the elongated figure surrounded by squiggles to show how he quaked as he ran from the threats of the blood tubs. "Only an attack of ager," they had his friends explaining. Before long, the Scotch plaid pattern was transferred from the cap to the cloak, which at last became a garment he had borrowed from his wife, whom he left at the mercy of imaginary assassins. In the North, there was shame behind the laughter and the sighs. Elation was high in the South, where people found themselves confirmed in their decision to leave a union, which soon would have such a coward for its leader. Certainly no one could picture Jefferson Davis fleeing from threats to his safety in a plaid disguise and surrounded by squiggles of fear. Mrs. Lincoln and the children arrived that afternoon, and the family moved into Parlor 6, Willard's finest, which between now and the inauguration became a little White House. To Parlor 6 came the public figures, resembling their photographs except for a third-dimensional grossness of the flesh, and the office seekers, importunate or demanding, oily or brash, as they had come to Springfield. Here, as there, Lincoln could say of the men who had engineered his nomination in Chicago, "They have gambled me all around, bought and sold me 100 times. I cannot begin to fill all the pledges made in my name." The card-writing stand in the lobby offered a line of cockades for buttonholes or hatbands, suitable for all shades of political sentiment, while elsewhere in the rambling structure, a peace convention was meeting behind closed doors, the delegates mostly old men who talked and fussed, advancing the views of their 21 states, 6 of them from the buffer region, but none from the Cotton South, until at last they gave up and dispersed, having come to nothing. Washington was a southern city, surrounded by slave states, and the military patrolled the streets, drilled and paraded and bivouacked in vacant lots, so the townspeople, waking to the crash of sunrise guns and blare of bugles, threw up their windows and leaned out in nightcaps, thinking the war had begun. Congress was into its closing days and finally in early March adjourned, having left the incoming president no authority to assemble the militia or call for volunteers, no matter what emergency might arise. Inauguration Day broke fair, but soon a cold wind shook the early flowers, and the sky was overcast. Then this, too, yielded to a change. The wind scoured the clouds away and dropped, so that by noon, when President Buchanan called for Lincoln at Willard's, the sky was clear and summer blue. along streets lined with soldiers, including riflemen posted at upper-story windows and cannoneers braced at attention beside their guns, the silver-haired 69-year-old bachelor and his high-shouldered successor rode in sunshine to the Capitol. From the unfinished dome, disfigured by scaffolds, a derrick extended a skeleton arm. A bronze freedom lay on the grass, the huge figure of a woman holding a sword in one hand and a wreath in the other, awaiting the dome's completion when she would be hoisted to its summit. In the Senate chamber, Buchanan and Lincoln watched the swearing-in of Vice President Hannibal Hamlin of Maine, so dark-skinned that campaign rumors had had him a mulatto, then proceeded to a temporary platform on the east portico, where they gazed out upon a crowd of 10,000. Lincoln wore new black clothes, a tall hat, and carried a gold-headed ebony cane. As he rose to deliver the inaugural address, Stephen Douglas leaned forward from among the dignitaries and took the hat, holding it while Lincoln adjusted his spectacles and read from a manuscript he took out of his pocket. A first draft had been written at Springfield. Since then, by a process of collaboration, it had been strengthened in places and watered down in others. Now, after months of silence and straddling many issues, he could speak, and his first words were spoken for Southern ears. "I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so." However, he denied that there could be any constitutional right to secession. "It is safe to assert that no government proper ever had a provision in its organic law for its own terms.